All right, well, good morning, folks, and welcome to our first plenary session of the day. It is my distinct pleasure to welcome and introduce Hilary Hines. Hilary Hines is senior lecturer in English literature at Lancaster University. Her principal area of research is in early modern writing, particularly work by women from the radical sects of the second half of the 17th century. And just recently, she published a book, George Fox and Early Quaker Culture, Manchester, 2011. Her other main publications are God's English Women, 17th Century Radical Sectarian Writing and Feminist Criticism, Manchester, 1996, an edition of the Prophet Anna Trapnell's The Cry of a Stone of 1654, Arizona Center for Medieval and Renaissance Studies, 2000, and the co-edited collection, Her Own Life, Autobiographical Writings by 17th Century English Women, Rutledge, 1989. And our talk today is Walking in the Light, Early Quaker Travel and the Literature of Pilgrimage. With that, let's welcome Hilary Hines.
Thank you, John, and thanks to Betty too for inviting me to speak here today. So, why travel when you've already arrived? This is the question that started me thinking about the habitual journeying of the early Quakers. For those of you familiar with the history of Quakerism, the question will, I hope, make sense. For this constant mobility seems to be at odds with the implications of the founding Quaker belief in the inward light, the light of God, which shone in everyone and which promised salvation to all who turned to that light and lived within it. On the one hand, the inward light brought with it a lexicon and a set of practices premised on movement. To be moved of the Lord was both a literal description of the start of a journey and a metaphorical description of a prompt from God to speak or act more generally. But on the other hand, Quakers were also insistent that the godly heart of the silent meeting for worship was stillness. So, for example, in a short epistle of 1652, George Fox exhorted friends to stand still in that which is pure after ye see yourselves, and then mercy comes in. Stand still in that which shows and discovers, and stand still in the light and submit to it. Your strength is to stand still. So if a turn to the light is matched by the stillness of one who dwells within it, then how are we to understand the restlessness at the heart of the early movement? If believers had, by definition, already arrived at their longed-for destination of union with the indwelling Christ, we might ask where the wayfaring Quaker was going. If the light within rewrote the promise of Christ's return as already fulfilled and therefore present in this time and this place, what kind of holy journeys were friends making? And if silence and stillness were the ideals of Quaker worship, the states closest to the divine towards which everything tended, why travel? That which was desired, the redemptive grace of God, was already present here and now. So why not stay put and dwell peacefully and attentively in that inward light? Well, for those of you less familiar with the history of the early Quakers, I want to underline just how extraordinary this culture of travel was, both in terms of the Quaker movement as a whole and in particular in the life of its early leader, George Fox. Quakerism was a movement that was born in the early 1650s, don't know where that came from, of the journeys of its wandering founder, George Fox, and sustained by the journeys of those who were convinced by him of the truth of the Quaker message, the publishers of truth, or travelling ministry, who traversed the country and beyond to spread the Quaker word. Fox's initial call from God required him to forsake all, and keep out of all, and be as a stranger unto all. The call was for a renunciation of worldly impediments in whatever form, but also a call to movement, or so at least Fox understood it. At the command of God, he tells us, I left my relations and break off all familiarity or fellowship with young or old. Consequently, his journal is as much a travelogue as it is a spiritual memoir, detailing his journeys through England, Scotland, Ireland, Northern Europe, and North America. And his journeying was matched by that of other early friends. The titles... there's his journal. The titles of publications reflecting on these early years confirm, I think, the defining importance of itinerancy to the movement as a whole. The titles of all the three texts here on the texts on this slide, they share this indicative composite emphasis on work, journeying, and suffering. Fox's career as a habitual traveller began early and continued throughout his life. Having left home at the command of God in 1643, age 19, he continued to travel more or less regularly until his final visit to Holland in 1684, as he was nearing 60. His journeying became more unremitting as the movement gathered pace. So, for example, in 1655, he crisscrossed most of southern England, visiting on foot and sometimes horseback, and often more than once in the course of that year. And excuse the rather inelegant shading, but this is just to give you a sense of where he travelled. In the course of that year, he went through Derbyshire, Leicestershire, London, Bedfordshire, Kent, Sussex, Berkshire, Essex, Suffolk, Norfolk, Cambridgeshire, Hertfordshire, Northamptonshire, Nottinghamshire, Warwickshire, Worcestershire, Surrey, Sussex, Hampshire, Dorset, and Devon, covering in that year a distance, by my calculation, thank you to Google Maps for this, of between 1,700 and 1,800 miles. So to be moved of the Lord clearly required significant levels of determination and stamina. When Fox's journeys are set alongside those of other friends, the geographical coverage becomes still more impressive. In the course of 1654 and 1655, Fox and his fellow friends moved south as far as London, Bristol, and Cornwall, west into Wales, and north into Scotland. At the same time, they went overseas, to Ireland in 1654, to Barbados 1655, and to New England in 1656. By the end of the 1650s, with the movement still less than a decade old, friends had, in their own words, and in what the Quaker historian William Braithwaite calls a fine confusion of geography, visited Germany, America, and many other islands and places, as Florence, Mantua, Palatine, Tuscany, Italy, Rome, Turkey, Jerusalem, France, Geneva, Norway, Barbados, Antigua, Jamaica, Suriname, Newfoundland, through all which friends have passed in the service of the Lord. Unsurprisingly, such an extensive programme has led to these early Quaker journeys being called one of the most dramatic outbreaks of missionary enthusiasm in the history of the Christian Church. So travel was central to Quaker practice, but also to Quaker writing. The narrative of Fox's journal is shaped by his extensive public travels in the service of truth, but also by his habitual localized walking. His early walking was often a sign of unease. When he was troubled, he says, he walked abroad in solitary places many days, and frequently in the night walked mournfully about by myself. Indeed, such solitary walking was itself a means to fulfill God's call to him, to forsake all and keep out of all and be as a stranger unto all. And this, Fox writes, is what determined his life course. He says, I gave myself up to the Lord, having forsaken all evil company and taken leave of father and mother and all other relations, and travelled up and down as a stranger in the earth, which way the Lord inclined my heart. After this, Fox aligns himself to his calling through a series of renunciations and separations from places and people, a stripping away of carnal ties to allow God to reclaim for himself that which is already his own. In line with the well-established Christian tradition and echoing the wanderings of both Christ and St. Paul, Fox's journal conflates the life and the journey. But it portrays that journey as a sequence without progression. Fox's journal shows him walking on a grand scale and on a local scale. He walks in doubt and in trouble, but also in certainty and sometimes in triumph. But above all, he walks in confirmation of the truth and as an act of service. He walks with purpose, but without a predetermined goal or destination. His walks are often solitary as a stranger in the earth, but they're also social, acts of companionship with his intermittent fellow travellers. His walks are generative. His passage back and forth across the country produces a quickly growing community of friends. But his walking is also performative, an opening of himself to God, which in turn elicits the Lord opening his truths to him. In short, Fox's walking was not incidental. It was not just a way of getting from A to B, but it was profoundly constitutive of what we know of his life, of the wider movement, and of the journal. In the rest of this paper, I want to turn my focus away from the history of early Quaker travel, the practicalities of where and by what means and to what ends Quakers travelled. Rather, I want to consider the rhetoric and the poetics of Quaker travel. By rhetoric, I mean I want to think of the travel itself as an act of communication, an address made to those encountered on the journey, that seeks to persuade its addressees of the power and the truth of the Quaker message. So if travelling itself is a rhetorical act intended to persuade or convince its hearers of this, how does it do it? And by saying I want to consider the poetics of Quaker travel, I mean that I want to pay attention to the language, the structure of all that's left of those journeys, namely the textual remains, the written accounts that Quakers produced. And here I'll focus on the Journal of George Fox, an account that's organised around his itinerant life. So I want to think about how journeying structures the narrative. On what elements of the journey does he linger? What does he omit? So in general, what was distinctive about the early Quaker culture of travel, and how might we begin to account for this? Well, I want to start this consideration with an example, probably one of the best known incidents in Fox's journal and indeed in Quaker history and mythology. In May 1652, Fox had already been on the road for a number of years, but there could not as yet be said to be a Quaker movement. He and Richard Farnworth are travelling together when they come to Pendle Hill in Lancashire. This is what Fox writes. As we went, I spied a great high hill called Pendle Hill, and I went on the top of it with much ado, it was so steep. But I was moved of the Lord to go atop of it. And when I came atop of it, I saw Lancashire Sea. And there atop of the hill, I was moved to sound the day of the Lord. And the Lord let me see atop of the hill in what places he had a great people. So here in his account of his Pendle Hill experience, with its vision of the gathering of a great people and the founding of a movement, what is perhaps most striking is Fox's fusion of the physical landscape through which he was travelling with the spiritual contours of the environment to which he bore witness. Pendle Hill is a natural feature of looming physical presence. The words top or atop occur 5 times in these few lines, and the steepness, he says, causes him much ado. But the hill is also a place of prominence in his spiritual landscape, ascended with difficulty, but with godly impetus. Moved of the Lord to climb the hill, and once there, moved to sound the day of the Lord. The sense of the human subject toiling up atop of the hill gives way to the spiritual subject in a spiritualized landscape. There, Fox's physical vision of Lancashire Sea combines with a spiritual vision of a great people and the places in which they dwelt. The topography of Fox's vision gives form to its articulation and suggests the rich possibilities for Quaker discourse of the blending of a sense of place with spiritual commentary. Fox's Pendle Hill vision, with its sense of toil and the spiritual rewards it yields, brings me to the second element of my title, the literature of pilgrimage. For Fox's merging of the topographical and the spiritual, and this incident's status as a way station on a longer journey, aligns it with a substantial medieval and early modern literature of pilgrimage. Like the narrator in the medieval pilgrimage poem Piers Plowman, Fox went wide in this world, wonders to hear. As in all pilgrimage literature, and indeed as in pilgrimage itself, here the external and the internal journey are intertwined. And this tradition of literary pilgrimage continued after the Reformation into the 17th century. So perhaps Fox's travels might be legible as part of the tradition of writing in which the Christian life is represented as a journey, or more particularly, as a pilgrimage. Protestantism had abolished the practice of pilgrimage, seeing it as a corrupt and theologically faulty Catholic exercise premised on the erroneous idea that the fallen human subject might, by their own efforts, intervene in their spiritual destiny and improve their prospects of salvation. But Protestantism had retained pilgrimage as a powerful and pervasive metaphor for the internal processes by which an individual should conduct their spiritual life. So Calvin, who condemned journeys to holy sites, also wrote, "Christ teaches us to travel as pilgrims in this world." Such journeys were to be interior, however, undertaken only metaphorically. And it was as such that 17th century writers such as John Donne, George Herbert, Henry Vaughan, Thomas Traherne, and John Bunyan embraced the idea of the Protestant pilgrimage. Sometimes they figure their explorations of the spiritual life simply as a journey, such as John Donne's Good Friday, 1613, riding westward, his meditation on the crucifixion stirred by his own journey. "When my soul's form bends towards the east," he wrote. Or we could think about Thomas Traherne's poem Walking, which develops its figurative engagement with the traversal of a landscape from the opening observation that to walk abroad is not with eyes but thoughts the fields to see and prize. More particularly, such writers developed the idea of the internal and the individual pilgrimage, but always insistently as a metaphorical one, as an unambiguous figure or allegory through which to explore the contours, the landmarks, the privations and the promise of the spiritual life. And George Herbert's poem, The Pilgrimage, is perhaps the clearest instance of this and serves to exemplify this subgenre. I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'll just read the first couple of stanzas to give you a flavour of it. It says, "I travelled on, seeing the hill where lay my expectation. A long it was and weary way. The gloomy cave of desperation I left on the one, and on the other side, the rock of pride. And so I came to fancy's meadow, stroud with many a flower. Fair would I here have made abode, but I was quickened by my hour. So to Care's copse I came, and there got through with much ado." And so on. Well, Herbert's pilgrimage is an arduous one. Just as Fox had much ado to get atop of the hill, so Herbert's pilgrim uses the same words, much ado, to describe his long and weary way through his own spiritualized landscape. The irregular line lengths enact the stopping and starting, the stumbling and the pausing the journey comprises. The poem conveys, I think, an extraordinary sense of how the questing and troubled believer makes sense of his life through a religious framework that's premised on obstacle and entrapment. First, the cave of desperation and the rock of pride threaten the progress of this pilgrim. Later, it's the wild of passion and the disappointment of the lake of brackish waters that he finds on top of the gladsome hill of hope. Just as was the case for Fox on Pendle Hill, so in this poem, the physical world is a text that reveals, for those who care to look, the will of God. Fox's Hill prompts a vision of a new movement. Herbert's Pilgrim finds a bleaker landscape of doubt, disappointment, and temptation, where hope is illusory. But both take the conventional Christian equation between life, landscape, and journey as their foundation and extend its metaphorical possibilities in accordance with the rhetorical task in hand. The terms and the direction of Herbert's poem are so ostentatiously and relentlessly metaphorical that they read almost like a prototype or a miniature of the most famous Protestant pilgrimage text, John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress. There, in his author's apology, Bunyan answers anticipated objections to his dependence on fancy or the imagination by reminding his readers of the biblical precedent for such an approach. He says, "The prophets used much by metaphors to set forth truth. Yea, whoso considers Christ, his apostles too, shall plainly see that truths to this day in such mantles be. Truth dwells within these figures," he says. "My dark and cloudy words, they do but hold the truth as cabinets enclose the gold." What's more, he says, the purpose of his tale is to teach his readers how to live metaphorically too. His fancies will instruct them to read the circumstances of their own lives as ephemeral and insubstantial, meaningful only for the spiritual meanings embedded in the material shell. He says, "This book will make a traveller of thee, if by its counsel thou wilt rule it be. It will direct thee to the holy land, if thou wilt its directions understand. Yea, it will make the slothful active be, the blind also delightful things to see." So the aim, Bunyan says, is to detach readers from the distractions, the empty promises of their human lives played out in the wilderness of this world, and to fix their eyes instead on the celestial city. The assiduous reader will find that the book exposes this world as transient and unreal, merely a shadow or figure of what is to come, and will thereby be converted to the greater reality of metaphorical pilgrimage. Life on earth in this model is distinct from, but also a metaphorical engagement with, the life to come. Distrust its contours, distrust their apparent significance, distrust the glittering appeal of its temptations and its pitfalls, we're told. Instead, we should read these as metaphors of the greater spiritual reality of a life lived with a view to the afterlife. In this way, the book will make a traveller of thee, focusing the mind on the journey from this life to the next. So for Bunyan, paradoxically, to live metaphorically was in fact to live more truly. Well, this metaphorical model is, of course, a fundamentally binary one. This life is distinct from the next life. Now is distinct from then. The inward is distinct from the outward, and the human is distinct from the divine. As the literary critic Thomas Luxon put it in his study of Puritanism and allegory. This is in a book called Literal Figures. It's a long quotation, but I hope you can bear with it. This is what Lutzen wrote. He said, "No version of Christianity is more committed than Calvinism to the absolute separation between this world and the next. God is everywhere represented in his creation, especially in man, but our ontological relation and God's remain as distinct from each other as figure and thing figured, except in the single exceptional case of Christ's sojourn on earth." Even in his Christology, Calvin emphasizes the distinction between, rather than the combination of, the divine and human. The divine is never human. Soul is never body. This world is never changed into the next or mingled with the next. The eternal does not participate in the temporal. The divine may manifest itself in the human, hid under a humble clothing of flesh, but the two remain as distinct as sign and thing signified. In this world is no fulfillment, only signs and shadows. So I think what he's saying is that it's not that there's no correspondence between these two binary terms. Indeed, their very polarity structurally finds a profound relation between them. But it is the case that for Puritans such as Bunyan and indeed George Herbert, those two worlds exist on different planes, and the relationship between them is complex. On the one hand, the two terms are utterly distinct. As Lutzen puts it, the divine is never human, the soul is never body. The two are thus to be understood in contradistinction to each other. But, on the other hand, the two are also to be understood as yoked together in a fundamental and analogical relation. And in particular, the greater spiritual reality is figured by the lesser, grosser, yet also more shadowy material reality. Truth is hidden in illusion and distraction. So this world and this life are to be read carefully, avidly, ceaselessly, for the metaphorical truths they tell us about the spiritual life. And the metaphorical relation forms a conceptual and interpretative bridge between these two polarized terms, forms a kind of bridge between these two terms. So, if the metaphorical relation is fundamental to Protestant pilgrimage literature, what becomes of it in Quaker discourse? Does Fox's metaphorized landscape render his journey an instance of Protestant pilgrimage, an internal journey made external through the translation of the earthly terrain into a spiritual one? Is his long and taxing climb atop of the hill offered in the spirit of Christian's journey in Pilgrim's Progress or George Herbert's speaker in his poem? Is the metaphorical truth of the Pendle Hill incident greater than, more substantial than, the material reality in which it's embedded? Do his journeys share the Protestant pilgrimage's emphasis on the revelation of a greater spiritual reality imminent in the contours of this fallen world? Well, yes and no, I think. Yes, in that there's no doubt that the Pendle Hill incident resonates with the sonorous and double-voiced power of myth, its literal features enriched by the apprehension of a greater metaphorical truth. Fox's Hill is in this sense akin to George Herbert's Hill. Both Fox and Herbert's Pilgrim find spiritual insight by undertaking their arduous ascents. However, where Herbert's Pilgrim's journey is only metaphorical, Fox's is also literal. The meanings he elicits from the landscape emerge from Pendle Hill, near Clitheroe in Lancashire, not from an unlocated, unnamed, imagined hill, representative only of the traveller's expectation. Contrary to Calvin's injunction that all pilgrimages be internal, Fox and the other early friends reclaimed the spiritual journey as a literal and lived phenomenon. As Michel de Certeau, the French historian, put it, they took the story literally. De Certeau writes, "Social delinquency consists in taking the story literally, in making it the principle of physical existence, where a society no longer offers to subjects or groups symbolic outlets and expectations of spaces, where there's no longer any alternative to disciplinary falling into line or illegal drifting away. That is one form or another of prison and wandering outside the pale." De Certeau's words have an uncanny applicability to the situation of the early Quakers. In their early years, they were seen as social as well as religious delinquents, vagrants, madmen, and blasphemers. Moreover, De Certeau's references to displacement, prison, and wandering point to three of the defining social and spiritual circumstances of early friends. So Quakers habitually took the story literally. They refused the metaphoricity of the Protestant spiritual journey, and they made it literal, exploiting its rhetorical and polemical potential to preach the inward light, make new convincements, and reveal the simultaneous godliness and ungodliness of the world through which they moved. However, to take that Pendle Hill incident as indicative of a broader narrative strategy in Fox's journal would, I think, be misleading. The Pendle Hill episode is so striking precisely because of its singularity in Fox's account. Few, if any, other encounters or incidents have such metaphorical resonance. More typically, Fox's journal offers a bare itinerary of his route with no obvious metaphorization, no sense of two worlds or of progression towards an ultimate destination. The journeys terminate or are interrupted. They never reach the completion offered by the celestial city of Bunyan's allegory. A random page from the journal, and this one is from 1656, shows the more typically prosaic tone of Fox's account of his journeys. "And after," he wrote, "after we passed from Exeter through Colompton and Taunton," lower down the page, "and from thence we came to Podimore, to William Beaton's. And from thence we came to John Dando, where we had another precious meeting. And from thence we came to Bristol." If Bunyan's Christian walks with one eye on the shimmering celestial city on the horizon, Fox's account has him wandering from village to town, from friend to friend, with purpose, but without apparent direction. It's not the case that his journey didn't lend itself to metaphorization. As we've seen quite clearly with the Pendle Hill incident, the endurance required, the challenging terrain, has much in common with that encountered by Herbert and Bunyan's pilgrims. Fox's journal could have made of him a Quaker pilgrim, a Christian whose journey, with its rigours and privations, was the literal and historical counterpart of the metaphorical Protestant pilgrimage texts, reading the material details of landscape and way and terrain, orientation and gradient as metaphor, saturated with spiritual significance. Fox's was a journey that, in other authorial hands, could easily have become another metaphorical providentialist narration. But this doesn't happen. The journal, despite its structural reliance on Fox's journeys, makes little of them. As a rule, we don't know which routes he travelled, we don't know how long the journeys took, don't know the nature of the terrain, nor whether the ways were arduous. It's rare that he tells us whether he was on horseback or on foot, more frequently only noting that he passed on from or came to a place. I think this is in part the result of a more general Quaker disinterest in the details of daily carnal materiality, but the outcome is a narrative whose emphasis falls principally on the pauses in the journeys rather than on the journeys themselves. Details of those journeys figure only when they're productive of openings of truth, or occasionally when we learn that he spent the night under a hedge. In other words, when something intervenes to halt the figure in motion. So, narratively speaking, the journeys are hazy and partial, little more than the threads along which are strung the places and the encounters told by the journal. Rather than being immediately legible as metaphorical pilgrimages, they seem to make more sense when they're analysed through a model offered, again, by Michel de Certeau in his study of the grammar and rhetoric of urban walking, and in particular, I think, through reference to the stylistic figure of Ascenderton. So Ascenderton being the suppression of linking words, such as conjunctions and adverbs. This figure, de Certeau argues, could also be said to structure accounts of spatial practices. In walking, he says, it selects and fragments the space traversed. It skips over links and whole parts that it omits. Ascenderton cuts out. It undoes continuity and undercuts its plausibility. A space treated in this way and shaped by practices is transformed into enlarged singularities and separate islands. In Fox's text, we could say that the journeys are the omitted conjunctions, adumbrated in such refrains as, so from thence, and from thence I passed through, but rarely elaborated and given almost no narrative weight. Instead, the places of departure and arrival are the enlarged singularities and the separate islands between which he moves. In A Pilgrimage, the journey and the destination yield meaning, but in Fox's account, it's the staging posts. The Ascenderton of the journal produces the journeys as sketchy adjuncts to a series of departures and arrivals. Their means not to an end, but to many ends and many beginnings. To depart is to refuse stasis, to refuse integration, but it's also to produce a new kind of identity. As Eric Leed puts it in his book, The Mind of the Traveller, the departure not only excorporates a member from a social body, it also incorporates and inaugurates the mobile body. It was certainly the very mobility of friends which often provided a means of classifying them. Their mobility allowed anti-Quakers to name them as vagrants. Having been identified in any given place as some version of friend or foe, departure from it both detaches Fox from those categorisations and returns him to an identity in conformity with the Lord's will as a stranger unto all. Habitual departure facilitates a process of categorisation whereby Fox is made legible to those he encounters, whether as vagrant and religious dissident, or as friend and publisher of truth. If his departures return him to the desired status of stranger in the earth, so his repeated arrivals produce encounters with other strangers that elicit a response, and rarely does the journal suggest that this is one of indifference. Invariably, these encounters are characterised by either hospitality or hostility, a polarisation that reproduces and confirms the overwhelmingly binary analytic perspective of early Quakers. The hospitality might be in the form of sympathisers whom Fox seeks out, or maybe in the form of people who listen and are turned to the Lord. Hostility is to be found in companies of rude people, he tells us, who deride, beat, or otherwise abuse him, or perhaps in hostile justices or in the clergy. This pattern of encounter and departure, hospitality and hostility, is repeated countless times through Fox's journal. And it's a pattern which makes Fox a catalyst whereby the godliness or the ungodliness of those he meets is revealed. Each new encounter replays the triumph of the power of the Lord and the light within, and the defeat of Satan. It's this process that, above all, keeps Fox on the move. His journeys produce repeated arrivals, new or renewed encounters in new or revisited places. In each instance, the power of the Lord is revealed and reiterated. Now, this cycle of visit and return not only catalyzes the division of the godly from the ungodly, but it also pulls the places themselves through which he travels into the drama of the light within. In de Certeau's terms, the places through which he moves are themselves transformed by his presence into spaces, where by place he means an indication of stability, reducible to the being there of something dead, and where space is understood as composed of intersections of mobile elements. It's, in a sense, actuated by the ensemble of movements deployed within it. So he concludes in his much-quoted aphorism that, in short, space is a practiced place. So place is brought alive by this process. And by this analysis, Fox's journeys serve perpetually to transform the stasis of place from the being there of something dead into the practiced flux and energy of space. It literally brings it to life. Fox's walking of the streets and the roads and the hills separates the hospitable from the hostile, turns the godly amongst them to the Lord, activating this embedded potential. So Fox continues in his cycle of departure and arrival because, as well as encountering manifestations of the inward light in this place and this person, he's equally open to being persuaded by the Lord of the importance of finding it there, in that person. So to return to my opening question of why travel when you've already arrived, one answer would be because there's no good reason to pause in one place rather than another. It's not that the next place offers anything different. Rather, the point is that it offers more of the same. It allows a reenactment of the drama of the arrival of the stranger in the earth, with its polarizing cycle of welcome and rejection, both equally important to the basic binary analysis by which friends understood the world, the hostile, the friendly, the godly, and the ungodly. So Fox is an agent whose introduction into this inadequately differentiated mix precipitates the necessary separation between the friendly and the hostile. Am I allowed a couple of extra minutes? Yes. Is that all right? Okay, good. It's hard for him to say no at that point, isn't it? Okay. So we're moving towards the end, but there's this one other little section that I'm kind of fond of, so I'd like to leave it in there. So this cycle of departure and arrival is sustained by walking. Walking, an activity that's at once habitual, taken for granted, but also indicative of what constitutes humanity. The literary critic Peter Stalibras has remarked that the mystery of walking is the mystery of a forked animal who stands erect, if at all, only through the incorporated sense of balance that the hand of another has given. That is to say, what enables us to move through the world autonomously is the result of a prior dependence, which, Stalibras argues, is never absolutely superseded, but is rather incorporated into the self. So it was with Fox. His travels, apparently autonomous, were, he repeatedly said, acts of dependence, contingent on the leadings of the Lord. What's more, the physiology of walking itself reproduces the precariousness of that initial relation. Oliver Wendell Holmes, 19th century physician and writer, described walking as a perpetual falling with a perpetual self-recovery. And he goes on, "It is a most complex, violent, and perilous operation which we divest of its extreme danger only by continual practice from a very early period of life. We learn how violent it is when we walk against a post or a door in the dark. We discover how dangerous it is when we slip or trip and come down, perhaps breaking or dislocating our limbs, or overlook the last step of a flight of stairs, and discover with what headlong violence we have been hurling ourselves forward." Holmes finds a disguised, because habituated, danger and violence animating the act of walking, which is only detectable when it's interrupted. This sense of an inherent but unnoticed instability to walking is echoed by de Certeau. He says, "Movement is loss of equilibrium. That falling becomes walking if it happens to be the case that a second place exists to follow the first." Here again, in the proximity of falling and recovery, human frailty and redemptive grace is the double contingency of the walk enacted. It's contingent in its dependence and its relationality, but also in its instability or unpredictability. Okay, and now really into my conclusion. So the mundanity of this analogy between walking and providence is itself apposite, I think, because it was in this most unremarked of day-to-day practices that Fox found evidence of the presence of the light within. De Certeau wrote of another Protestant mystic that his own text was his walking. He wrote with his feet, that is, geographically. Fox's testimony was also an embodied one, produced in dialogue with the people and the places that he visited. By repeatedly inscribing the landscape with their journeying, Fox and other early Quakers brought to the surface and brought to life the godly potential of these spaces and their inhabitants. Unlike pilgrimages, the journeys themselves were of little intrinsic interest to those who undertook them. But, like pilgrimages, what mattered was what followed from them. The movement with which Fox was most concerned was to be found not in his own mobility, in the extraordinary journeys that he undertook, but was to be found in the towns and the villages where he paused. There, the motion he reports most frequently is the turning to the light of God. And just as speech leads to silence in the economy of the meeting for worship, so this motion led quite properly to a kind of stillness in the settling of meetings. Settling, however, was not for Fox and other itinerant Quakers. In their pattern of departure and arrival, the journeys demonstrate the power of the inward light to turn and to save. So a Quaker answer to the question with which I began, why travel when you've already arrived, would suggest that, unlike for the pilgrim, the itinerary is immaterial, for the light shines everywhere. Instead, the itinerancy is critical, because to travel was also to travail. To walk is a literalization of St. John's words: if we walk in the light as he is in the light, we have fellowship with one another. Combining fellowship and redemption, itinerancy enacts the fusion of the material and the spiritual, contrary to the two-world model of Protestant literary pilgrimage. Quakers returned the pilgrimage to the material world, but they remade that journey as both literal and spiritual. For the early Quakers, world and body are not insubstantial, fallen impediments to be shuffled off by the subject redeemed by death. Nor are they metaphorical signs of God's providential gift to his elect. Instead, their matter redeemable, transformable by the godly action of the catalyzing Christ within. In this, the continuity of the material spiritual world of the early Quakers is revealed, enacted, and affirmed. Thank you.
All right, thank you so much. Are there any questions?
My name's Richard Evans. I'd like to preface this, what I'm saying, in that I went on the Quaker Youth Pilgrimage, all right, in various places where George Fox was going to visit it. I think in terms of talking about his journeying, I think it's very difficult to plan when you know that at any point you are going to be potentially arrested and thrown in prison, and how a significant amount of George Fox's life was in prison, and how his life was shortened by those prison conditions. So yes, he did travel, I'm not disputing that. But you referenced the precious meeting. I read the journal and I had this impression that it's later on where precious meeting is mentioned, whereas in the first two thirds meeting isn't described as a precious meeting. And I wonder whether somebody else was scribing for him. He was no longer writing his own journal. It was somebody diarising.
Well, the journal was dictated and transcribed from the outset. I mean, it's all in somebody else's hands. So, I think it's an... And it was revised as it was dictated as well. So if you look at the manuscript, you can see... the crossings out, you can see the interlineations, and can begin to get a bit of a sense of the process of composition. So it's a complicated business, I think, that business of composition. My sense is that there is a kind of continuity kind of running through it, rather than somebody else's voice taking over. But I think it's not straightforward. I think the words precious meeting, my sense is that comes in earlier than the final third, but I'd need to go back and.
It could, but it's definitely not in the first half. It's later on. It's after he's been in Lancaster jail. I don't recall seeing it.
Okay.
And then it's a fairly consistent occurrence after that.
And what do you make of that?
You're wondering, has his voice changed, or
okay,
has it become a phrase used amongst Quakers at that time?
Well, that whole narrative strand is retrospective. So I guess if it does come in the second part of the journal, that's something I'd need to look at again. But it's an interesting point. But I'm not sure that it's to do with. Given that it's all retrospective, you know, the main narrative element, I'm not sure what that would tell us about the change in usage.
Right.
But it's something that, it's something that I could have a look at, certainly, yeah. As for the kind of the practicalities of Fox's journey, I think, I mean, there's been obviously a lot of kind of historical work done on that, work done on the preparation that was made for the journeys, the sending ahead of texts to prepare communities for the arrival of travelling friends. So, yes, you're right, there's an awful lot that's already known, and no doubt more that could be known about those, the way that those journeys were practically constructed. I guess what I'm focusing on more here is the way those journeys figure within the accounts, the way in which they've become this very, apart from the Pendle Hill incident, and maybe one or two others, but principally that one, the way that the journeys have become a very kind of sparse and partial account. I guess when I first read it, I thought, well, he's missing a trick here. You know, there's more that could be done along the line of this Pendle Hill incident that just doesn't happen. And that's what I was trying to kind of take account of in the paper, is the way that those journeys serve rhetorically within the journal, even though they don't do what the Pendle Hill incident does do.
Hi, I had a question about, if you could stand up. The Pendle Hill thing, because as I'm sure you're well aware, it's the 400th anniversary of the Pendle Witch Trial. Is there any connection between him having this mystical experience up there and knowledge of what had been going on 40 years before?
Well, yes, an interesting question, one I think that has attracted quite a lot of speculation over the years. I haven't found any concrete evidence of that, of an awareness of that, of that link. I mean, it's an area, however, which, I mean, as well as the Pendle Witch connection, has a history that relates to other kinds of radical religious activity as well. So Grindleton is nearby, and there was a group known as the Grindletonians who'd been active in the 1630s, I think I'm right in saying. So it may be that that history of radical religion had as much or maybe more of a part to play in Pendle Hill assuming that kind of quality that it does assume within the journal. But I haven't seen anything that would suggest that an awareness of the Pendle Hill. Sorry, of the Pendle Witches trial. I don't know. I wish I did.
Kevin.
Yeah, I was deeply found your talk very moving. The one thing you kind of opened up is contrasting Fox's journey wasn't to a celestial city, as Bunyan had talked about, but the whole question of purpose. Wondering, heard a little bit of this, but how much did the whole theme of walking cheerfully about the earth, answering that of God in every person, pointing to people to Christ their teacher, and the culmination of that is the idea of a realized eschatology, that it wasn't some future event, but Christ had come. How much of that dominated the purpose of his life?
I think that's absolutely fundamental. I mean, I think it's that sense of the presence of the inward light here and now. I mean, presence both sort of temporally but also spatially. So in this place and in this body, that kind of collapsing of time, which you're talking about in a sense there, that sense of the second coming, having already been realised through that turn to the inward light, seems to me absolutely fundamental, absolutely crucial to the way that Fox experienced his life and his journey, and also, more precisely, I guess, the encounters that he does narrate through the journal. So I think that's absolutely fundamental to the account of the travels that we get there, and produces, I think, that sense of sequence without progression. Because progression implies a kind of temporality which is irrelevant now. Doesn't make any sense anymore with this already returned Christ.
So he's moving from somewhere that he's arriving at places, but he's already arrived. Mm. You know, that he's there already.
Yeah.
And then he's there already somewhere else.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Sense.
Yes. The time ceases to the journey continues through space. But it doesn't continue through time. Time ceases to kind of have that progressive quality, I think, in the journeys, which is why, yes, it seems to me, why pause here? Why not go somewhere else? There's no sense of any promise of anything different, because this, you know, more of the same is the point, as I say. Yeah.
Please. I thought it was a marvellous talk. Absolutely fantastic. The connections I really want to ask you about is that what I was thinking about all the time you were explaining and talking about the walk that really actually never arrives at any particular point in, is that to connect it with what the Romantic movement then took up of walking, which brought in walking as a kind of a smart habit in a way that it had never ever existed before. And in a sense, the whole kind of trajectory of Romantic walking right through to the concept of the beats and going, no particular place to go, you know, the kind of vulgar, is the way that has to some extent maybe come down in a number of complex kind of translations from what you're talking about. I don't know if I've made that clear, because I'm really still quite shell-shocked about how good your talk was and how stimulating it was and the kind of resonances. But basically what I'm saying is, I've always taught that walking was invented in the Romantic movement. Before that, it was for peasants and for people who had to do it. And then it suddenly assumed this transcendental kind of quality, except nature was put rather than God as the kind of... And I just wonder if you'd like to talk to
that. Yes, well, no, that's interesting, because when I started working on this, I looked to critical accounts which might help me think about it, and all the ones that I found were about Romanticism and walking. And I found them interesting, but they were interesting almost as kind of counter cases, because it seemed to me that Fox was traversing the landscape in a very different way, that he wasn't looking to the landscape as a source of the sublime. He wasn't looking to the landscape as a source of divine mystery, even. He encountered it there, but he could encounter it, you know, in a village or a farmhouse as easily as he could on Pendle Hill. So the landscape erupts into the account very seldom. You know he's walking because he has those, you know, then I went here and then I went there. But there's none of that sense of the landscape being actively or consciously productive of the process which I think is going on in terms of that process of opening of kind of divine truths. It might be, as I say, it might be in the countryside, but it might be in Bishopsgate, or it might be in Bristol or wherever. So terrain has a kind of it has a kind of sameness. It has a kind of flatness. It's as I said, it seems as if the quality of the of the spaces that he was moving through, they remain spaces. I mean, they're almost like they're empty. They're not part of the account in any kind of way that we might expect from having looked at Romantic accounts of the natural encounter, I think.
But in a sense, there is a link, I think, a similarity in one very, very broad sense, is that both Fox and the Romantics were giving semiotic value to a process, walking, which hadn't really been treated as anything, except occasionally in the Bible. I once tried to do a walking following in the footsteps of Robert Louis Stevenson. And when you've been walking for a long period, you suddenly become aware of biblical resonances. Like when I left a place, I remember the line in the Bible, I shook off the dust. It was Paul, I think, saying, I shook off the... And you actually see that when you do it.
Right.
So there is a... But what I'm basically saying is that walking was a completely valueless, empty, free area, really, until the... And when it became... Yeah. But what you're saying, and I agree with you from reading Fox, is that it is... that they made it something to actually focus on.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's time for lunch, but we could probably ask questions all afternoon. So let's give Hillary another round of applause and appreciation.